Less than 10 hours after the Japanese launched a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese invasion of the Philippines commenced. These events catalyzed the formation of the U.S. Army's 1st Filipino Battalion. Filipinos living in the United States volunteered for the military with a burning desire to return to their motherland and repel the enemy. Author Marie Silva Vallejo asks, why did they join when their entire life in California was debased with systemic and rampant anti-Filipino sentiment and legislation? What complicated patriotism had made thousands of Filipino men in America volunteer into the army despite decades of horrible inequities inflicted upon them? Was it even worth it? The 1st Filipino Battalion was formed, and around 7,000 eagerly volunteered, eventually completing their training at Camp San Luis Obispo, Camp Roberts, Fort Hunter Liggett, and Camp Beale before deploying to the Philippines. So many Filipinos signed up to serve that the 1st Infantry Regiment spawned the 2nd Filipino Regiment, and they all returned to the Philippines with the Allied Liberation Forces. The Filipino soldiers relayed vital information from General Douglas MacArthur to guerrilla units dispersed throughout the Philippines. When Silva learned that her father was a member of this clandestine unit, she was compelled to find out more. But the secrecy of the covert missions to the islands challenged the creation of their chronological history. Large gaps about their exploits in the Philippines were gleaned largely from guerrilla records to complete their story. For 10 years, Maria Silva Vallejo sought the answer to what her father did during World War II, leading her to uncover one of the Philippines' largest contributions to its own liberation, secret reconnaissance missions conducted by Filipino soldiers in the U.S. Army, chronicled in her new book, Dauntless. Following Vallejo's presentation at the San Luis Obispo Veterans Memorial Museum, she met with me for a conversation. Come along and join Vallejo to discover the rest of the story.
I'm Marie Vallejo, and I'm the author of the book, Dauntless. It's an untold story of the 1st and 2nd Filipino Infantry Regiment and a special unit out of it, mandated top secret by General MacArthur. So there's hardly any information on it, and nobody knows about their story.
How did you come to write it? Was your father involved?
Yes. I had gone back to the Philippines. I was retired, went back to the Philippines. I lived in California for a while. Somebody had sent me a pamphlet of a battle during World War II in a town north of Davao City, which is the capital of Mindanao. At the time that the liberating forces were liberating Davao, here's this regiment trying to remove a Japanese garrison 36 kilometers north of Davao. It was composed of guerrillas, civilians, fishermen, farmers, and who led the battle was my father.
Wow.
So I said, well, what did this man do? So that made me start to look for him. The topic was still his name, what his name. So I had put it on the internet.
And that's your middle name.
That's my middle name,
yeah.
Silva.
Yeah.
So I put his name out on the internet until finally I found it, and it was at the MacArthur Library. Now, why would my father's name would be in the MacArthur Library? So I started communicating to the archivist, James Sobel, and he was very helpful. Apparently, there was that from the regiment, there were 800 men that they interviewed. And of that 800 men, they had a 3x5 card for each of the men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it showed their height, what languages they could speak, what island they came from. Can they type? Can they steer a boat? Things of that sort. My father was on one of those 3x5 cards. So it started from there and expanded and connected it to the that he was on a submarine mission, but as part of a unit, but came from the 1st and 2nd Filipino Infantry Regiment.
So did he grow up in California?
No. My father was a It was under the American occupation at that time. He was already a teacher in the island of Mindanao. And of course, there were these advertisements that said, oh, come to the U.S., a land of plenty and of gold. So a lot of men then jump ship just to, improve themselves, maybe to gain another education in the U.S. and or find a better job. My first chapter of the book has, I describe that to give it a background. And he did. He was one of those men. His first job when he hit was as an apple picker in the fields, which is hundreds of men were like that too. That was their first job in California. But then he decided that he would like to go back to school. So he enrolled at the San Francisco State College, and he was a houseboy to one of the teachers. So I think that's how he was able to, go through school, graduate. As payment of it, he was a houseboy of that teacher. But he had to learn all the American ways, which is quite different from what he knew back in the Philippines.
So this was before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, this was before Pearl Harbor, but in the 30s. And so he did that, and he was also, then he found, a little secretarial job after he finished college. And the one nice thing was because I asked San Francisco State College at that time if they had his transcript, and they did.
Oh, wow.
His transcript of 1935.
Wow.
And so I looked at it, and I looked at the grades, and I said, oh, I think my father could have done better. Because there were pictures of him as being part of or president of some bachelor club in San Francisco.
How funny.
Anyway.
Okay, so Pearl Harbor
comes
along December 7th, 1941.
Yes, and I have a couple of photos of him deciding whether he would sign up or volunteer. Those men were really volunteers.
So the Filipino 1st and 2nd Regiment had not been formed yet?
Yes.
When he went in?
Yes. It was just like whoever volunteered, they were a battalion at that time. So they were coming in from all over the United States.
But it wasn't just Filipinos. It was everybody, anywhere. When he first went in the Army, the 1st Regiment hadn't formed yet, right?
Oh. They had a choice. Apparently, they had a choice that they could go with a Filipino group. So it wasn't like a segregated group, you know, like the Tuskegee. No, it was. They were given a choice. They were asked. I think some of them were asked, like, "What is your heritage? Are you Caucasian, Filipino, or what?" And then they said, "Oh, you have a choice. You could go to the Filipino," and they did. So they were all together, and then the President of the United States then formally created the 1st Filipino Battalion so they could bear arms.
But the advantage was having a cultural awareness of the Philippines, right?
Yes,
that
yes.
gave them an advantage, knowing Tagalog and cultural mores and whatnot.
Yes, exactly.
It's like our friend the Colonel Brune. His father was in the Norwegian regiment.
Exactly.
The same advantages.
The same advantages. And I guess the Army was smart in that sense that, and MacArthur too, he said, I'm going to use the Filipinos on those secret missions, especially in the secret missions, to arrive at the island that they knew the language, they could blend in.
When they first arrived, a lot of them were landed on submarines, right?
Yes, the secret unit, the ones that were sent to Australia. They were in submarines, and they landed in those islands. Now, there was a separate group, which is the combat group now, who landed in January of 1945. They were the regular Filipino regiments.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Did your father ever talk about his wartime experiences?
Not really. Mm-hmm. And I think we children are suffering because of that. The other children that I have talked to, they said their father hardly talked about it. Maybe they wanted to forget it.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember my father at times would say, oh, I stood here, and like he was be holding a gun. And then he'd go to the other side and said, oh, the Japanese did this.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't give him the chance to continue the story because I was a teenager by then.
And we were all self-absorbed in our own little world.
Self-absorbed at that time. And the thing is, the 800 men, I collated all of that 800 men that were interviewed. Less than 100 were under 30 years old.
That's crazy.
Yeah, because these men had already been there in the 20s and 30s, and then the war breaks out.
There were a couple guys in your book that you referenced that were over 50 years old.
Yeah, there were some of them were 50 years old. There was a time wherein, I think there was a rule in the army that said, okay, if you're over a certain age, you can leave the army, right. Stuff like that, you know. So a lot of them did. They just decided to, but that the same, maybe they couldn't handle the rigorous training. Mm-hmm. But there were some who were kept, and they were in their 40s. Mm-hmm. Of the 800 men, less than 100 were under 30 years old.
That's crazy. Typically, you know, like a kid would lie about his age.
Yes.
So he could say he's 18, but you mentioned lying about their age to say they're younger.
Yes, a lot of them lied about their age. Mm-hmm. My dad did. 2 years. I read about how they would help each other out and how they would dye their hair to cover the white hair that's coming out because they were already in their 30s.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. In California, in the 30s, there was some racism against Filipino people, and yet the Filipino people rose up and wanted to support their country and were some of the first to enlist. Isn't that a paradox in some ways?
Yeah, I kind of wondered too. I think one reason was that they were concerned about what would happen to their families in the Philippines.
Right.
So they fought under the American flag to remove the invaders from their homeland. And they knew that, you know, it was like a one-way ticket, a lot of that stuff. So that's kind of basically it, yeah.
Let's talk about the Philippines going back Spanish-American War. Okay, afterwards, what was the status of the Philippines? It was still kind of under the umbrella of the Americans, correct? Leading up until World War II.
Right.
Because you had the guerrillas and the separatist people that are still there. There's a lot of contradictions.
Yes, the Philippine-American War was for 4 years, you know, and it was bloody from what I read. I mean, they did waterboarding started then at that time. Can you imagine waterboarding?
Yeah.
But then they were pacified and so on. And then I guess they got convinced when America started the sanitation program, universal schooling, all these things that they did not have under the Spanish rule. Then the peacetime came, 1935, up to when the war started. My grandmother would talk about that was the best time.
Wow.
Yeah, 1935 up until the war started.
And there's another nuance I didn't really think about. A gentleman at your speech today had mentioned that there were Japanese who lived in the Philippines before World War II.
Yes. Yes.
So what happened to them?
Well, you know, before the war, there were the largest Japanese community outside of Japan was in Mindanao, Davao City. They had their own school, their own embassy, their own hospital.
And some of them had been there for generations.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. And so they were peaceful. And they actually did the abaca hemp industry. They were the ones who really taught Filipinos. The Filipinos learned a lot from them, too. Fishing things and stuff like that, and so on. Then the war breaks out. In Manila, you had the people who could afford. They had drivers and gardeners, and mostly Japanese, because they were very good at that. But when the war broke out, a lot of them turned into wearing their uniforms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they said that they were probably spying there even before that.
Interesting.
So actually, when the Japanese arrived in Mindanao, they were kind of welcomed by open arms by the Japanese community. Yeah. And I read stuff like they would go, oh, here's coffee and stuff. So I think they lived okay well during the Japanese period in Mindanao. But then when the Americans came, there was a sort of incarceration.
I bet.
Yeah. There was kind of a kind of an incarceration too. There was a program after the war, which in the Japanese government allowed the children of mixed marriages to go to Japan, become Japanese citizens and stuff. Well, I think I read that somewhere, yeah.
Interesting. In your research in your book, did you go to the Philippines and find some of the locales where...
I lived in the Philippines now. Actually,
now you're there?
I live there now.
Today, oh.
Yeah, I do. I retired from California, the company I worked for, and we decided to go back to the Philippines to retire.
Quality of life?
Well, you know, I truly believe I would not have been able to really concentrate on this book. There was a lot of details to combine if I didn't have easy help in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Somebody came in to clean and cook.
Which you couldn't afford to do here.
Which I can't afford to do here.
Yeah.
You know, I can't afford to do that here, but that was really nice. So I just concentrated on the book.
In what town are you in now?
I live in Bonifacio Global City. It's a new area right beside the Makati, the old business district. That's where the Manila American Cemetery is located.
Oh, wow.
It's a beautiful place. And I always tell people, friends and relatives who come, to enter that and tour it. Because right behind it, about several years ago, they set up a visitor center, which is really very nice.
Oh, wow.
And they're giving, once in a while, they'd get a Philippine historian to talk. And of course, I was one of them.
So a little bit more about your book. What's the breadth of what you wanted to communicate?
About 20, 30 years ago, I met a man named Alex Fabros. His father was also with the regiment. He did a thesis on the men. I met him by chance. They were having a conference on the men at the Marriott Hotel by Burlingame. I just happened to walk the hallway with my daughter because I was just curious. Oh, it's a nice hotel. Things like that. He comes out of the room. And I hear this Filipino infantry. And I go, huh? So I look. He comes out. He goes, are you interested? And I said, sort of. I think my dad was kind of, I knew nothing. And he said, who was your dad? And I gave him my dad's name, Saturnino Silva. And he said, you know, your dad's a hero. I didn't know that. And other people have also told me that. It seems that he gained the reputation with the men after the war on what he did. But Alex did a thesis. I got a copy of it and forms the framework of the book, the first part. Then they were sent to the Philippines. He stopped right there. I wanted to finish it all the way till the end, up to the current time.
The title of your book, once more.
I chose Dauntless because I figured these are suicidal missions and they still volunteered. I can't imagine, you know, what they did. So in the Philippines, where I first started with the book, nobody knew about the men. They always said, there was no Filipinos from the U.S., Marie. Filipinos. I said, yes, there were. No, everybody was just against me and say, no, there were none. So I had to go to the U.S. libraries and archives and MacArthur Library to get proof and more information. That's how it is.
Well, the first regiment trained right here at Camp San Luis Obispo, correct?
The first, when they were first started,
yeah. And then the second, they were more Fort Ord and Camp Beale?
There's a calendar, actually, of all that I place in the appendix of the book because they moved around. The first one was in San Luis Obispo, and they trained also in Morro Bay. Then there was Camp Roberts, Camp Beale, Camp Cook, Hunter Liggett. It's all in California.
That's really interesting. Neither here nor there, but I know that a lot of, I think the first and second trained at Salinas Fairgrounds. You have photos of the guys there.
Yeah, they were, I think, in the barracks or something, of the, where the stables were. And they said that before they arrived, the Japanese were concentrated there.
Before they sent them to
before
the...
Before they sent them out. And so then the Filipinos kind of took over. Rodeo ground, that's it.
A lot of the Filipino guys were from Salinas, right? They were field workers. And
I think majority of them were from the fields. They were all from the fields. And I think they probably figured also, well, you know what? Probably life is better in the service than on the farm because we're not going to get lynched.
Right.
I think so. So it expanded. Oh, and then I go through... Then after the war, what happens to them? The Rescission Act. Do you know about the Rescission Act?
You mentioned that in the book.
That was painful. That I don't like. When they were trying to drum up the Philippine Army to defend the Philippines, they said, and the President Roosevelt said this, those in the Philippine Army, if you join, you'll get the same benefits as a regular U.S. Army guy. So they did. And that swelled to hundreds of thousands. Of course, after the war... 1946 was the Rescission Act by Truman. He signed it.
And what did it say?
No benefits.
Wow.
That's why it's called the Rescission Act. Until now, that's why you hear them protesting, the veterans, like chaining themselves to the White House gates.
Wow.
Because of that. So why? Why did you do this to us? It's really sad. That part, I said, I don't know why the U.S. did that. Truman, you know? So that kind of what happened, the Rescission Act. My research, there's hint that to give the benefits plus the reparation would be billions of dollars. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
I think that was part of it, because that's what I keep reading.
Pretty brutal.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more about your book, because you talk about the training of the 1st and 2nd mm-hmm. Regiment. Mm-hmm. Then you also go island by island. What happened during the war?
Mm-hmm.
Give us a highlight of once they deployed and they were there.
Okay. I have a chapter there per island. Because of the submarine missions, like how many submarines would land on that island. I had to sort of make sure that it coordinates, because that same submarine would arrive in one island, Island A, and then proceed to Island B.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it a bit complicated, like which comes first, you know, right. Things like that. That was one thing that was kind of difficult. And sometimes they're not very detailed. I'd have to make an educated guess. But I hate doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the type that I have to have corroboration.
Where did you get your archival information from primarily?
The National Archives has the radio communications.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's there. The radio communications. But also the orders of the men. Okay, so you have a submarine coming in to, let's say, an island. But you have to find out, okay, so these men, how did they get their orders? So I would find their orders. So-and-so would have to leave as of this date and return in an indefinite date.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? I'm reading this and I'm like, oh, wow, you know? And they still volunteered. And then the after-action reports of some of the men detailed how they were asked to join. Let's say there's a submarine leaving for so-and-so, and then they would ask Whitney. Courtney Whitney was the aide of MacArthur who headed this submarine thing
mm-hmm.
and worked with Parsons. The men, they would tell their story and said, oh, Courtney Whitney, we were brought into this room. And he would tell us, he said, oh, you have a choice. You know, you can volunteer if you want to. If you don't, well, you know, here's a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
You walk out, you come back in and see if you're in. So they tell their story, and it's like, oh, that's how it is.
You wrote about an Anglo colonel who was born and raised or grew up in the Philippines and became a colonel in the United States military in the Army. And he was one of the heads of the 1st Filipino Regiment that you talk about.
Oh,
remember?
That's...
Yeah. I know. Offley. Yes.
Colonel Offley.
I was so touched by him.
Mm-hmm.
One, because of his comprehension and having been embedded in Filipino culture, fluent in Tagalog, and
yes.
and knowledgeable
yes.
intimately with the cuisine. I was telling somebody today
yeah.
that the Filipino cooks in the Army
yes.
would make these Filipino dishes that the troops love. And that's partly because of Offley.
Yeah, because yeah. of Offley. Mm. Offley's father was military governor, I think in Samar.
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up there. You know, a nine-year-old running around, spoke Tagalog. So probably the mother came to a point, he says, well, you know, I think I need to send you to the States for some education here, something else,
right,
you know?
Right.
He knew. So the men were very lucky to have Offley as their commanding officer.
What a godsend. Just.
Exactly.
Yeah, so touched.
And he protected them.
Mm-hmm.
He protected them. So, the part about the 1st and 2nd Filipino Regiment, he put infantry in there.
Mm-hmm. On purpose.
Yeah. It wasn't really, but he just, you know, ballooned into it to make sure that his men would not be mess.
Right.
And just be servicemen, you
yeah.
know, like the other colored groups or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was amazing, really.
It really was. That was one of the most touching little undertones in your book.
Me too. I would like, and it's in Mindoro. I don't know. I like to go to Mindoro and try to dig up in their libraries over there. You know, if they have about Offley.
He would be a great book himself. Yeah.
I'm tired already.
I know.
I'm resting. After this, that's it.
Yeah. Well, when you recover.
But yeah, there's a little snippets like this.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
Oh,
brings it to life. I know you've got to get on to fly away somewhere.
Oh, gosh, I can keep talking for hours, but because there's just so much information out there, but I'm fine.
I mean,
we can stop if you want.
Good to go. I just don't want to hold you captive.
No, I'm fine. We always make it like a little vacation.
Mm-hmm.
When I give a talk, we come the day before so we can rest. Have you been to the New Orleans World War II Museum?
I have not. I've communicated with them, but I'd love to go there, the World War II Museum.
Yes. In November, they've asked me to be on a panel. The topic is MacArthur's intelligence something.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably be part of the panel. And it's headed by James Scott, the one who wrote the book Rampage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the taking of Manila. Well, everybody who read that book, they all say, "Oh my God, atrocities! Too much."
Yep.
Too much atrocities.
Yeah. To learn more about your world, where would you direct us to buy your book or to find out more about you? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I do. I create a little simple one, really. It's just gowhenever.com.
Well, that's too easy.
Yeah, it's very easy, and it's just a very short website that introduces the men and where you can get the book, things like that. I don't have a staff. I'm doing all myself, even self-publication. Okay, after the Rescission Act, many years, they're chaining themselves, saying, "Why did you do this to us?" Then Obama comes out with the Congressional Gold Medal, saying that for every veterans, if they live in the U.S., they're paid one time $15,000, and then anybody in the Philippines, $9,000, that's it. There's even an area there regarding the medals that the men were awarded. There is some, I say, unfairness, and I put it in the book.
Talk us a moment about MacArthur, because he was such a Hollywood self-promoter. What did the Filipinos really think about him?
Okay. I think they like him. They think he's a hero, most of them. Then there are those, the learned ones. They form their own opinion. And a lot of them think that MacArthur was some egotistic blah, blah, blah. You know, okay. The more you're learned you are, the more you form these opinions. And then there are those who say that he abandoned the Philippines. And that's when I say, no, he was ordered. Twice.
Yeah, he turned down the order.
He turned down the first one. Yeah. He did. And I give my talk, I always say that. I just want to make clear, okay? There's some of you out there like that. And then there's, basically, they like MacArthur because he came back. He came back and got rid of, you know, the enemy and so on. What I don't like about is, I don't know whether I should say this.
It's okay.
He went straight to Japan. I think you know where I'm getting.
Yeah. Immediately after the war.
Immediately after the war. It's almost like you want to forget.
I think, again, it was his ego. And he basically was the commander of the Japanese nation post-war.
7 years in Japan. Yeah. I mean, he was like emperor in a way.
Yeah.
And he was good. He kept that emperor alive. Or else he would never have been successful, right?
He knew.
Yeah. But the Philippines was left behind to fix themselves, up by themselves, and with no help. And there was problems with reparation. There was problems with the awarding of some benefits to the guerrillas, because there was a guerrilla recognition program.
Anything else you want to add before we go?
Oh, I could keep talking. Like I said, I don't know. Bring up a topic or something.
Yeah.
But no, I guess that's it.
Okay.
And you have my email. So
I don't know if I do.
It's a gowhenever@yahoo.com.
All right, Marie. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad I was able to come here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.